Hi, Stella.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. We had Mia on the show today, Mia Hughes, the author of the report that accompanied the WPATH files released recently. And that was an amazing conversation.
Yeah, we got into all sorts with Mia. I consider her a friend now. I've just got to know her in the last few months quite intensely with the WPATH files, and she wrote such a beautiful piece of writing. It's such an important piece of writing, the report that goes with WPATH files, the WPATH files being the leaked conversations from the internal channels from WPATH. But Mia is a real, she's got a wealth of information, and she imparts it in such an interesting way. And this conversation that you and I had, Sasha, with Mia, it was so interesting, because not only did we talk about the WPATH files, but we also talked a lot about the medical scandals that have happened and the ethics of all of this. What just because we can, should we, kind of aspect of it. So there's so much in this conversation. I think we could have gone on for hours. It's already a very long conversation, and we could have gone on for hours.
Yeah. And what I really appreciate too, because those listeners who are here, you might have heard of Mia before. She's an amazing ex profile, Twitter ex, where she writes really informative and deep thinking threads about gender and gender medicine. But we also got to hear a little bit more about her personal story, which I haven't heard her share anywhere, like how she became aware of this gender stuff, her kind of journey, for lack of a better term, from being actually very what she calls woke to like realizing something very strange was happening in response to J.K. Rowling's very reasonable tweets. And so she kind of tells us how she got into this and how she really quickly realized that something very unhealthy is going on, not only with the way people responded to J.K. Rowling, but when she discovered what's happening to kids. And so she just went from, someone who left a career of teaching to homeschool her kids, to stay home with kids, to becoming a full-time writer covering gender issues. So it was a great conversation. We're sure everyone will appreciate it. Mia has a very clear and concise way of speaking about these things. She almost speaks as though she's written what she's going to say. She's like so put together. It's really nice to listen. Shall I read her bio and then we can jump in?
Go.
Okay. Mia Hughes is an Ottawa-based journalist primarily covering the gender issue for Environmental Progress, with a particular focus on the controversy of pediatric medical transition and how trans rights can collide with the rights of women and the LGB community. She also researches media bias and other issues for Environmental Progress as well. She previously covered the gender issue for The Postmillennial and has been published in The Critic, Lesbian and Gay News, and Gender Dissent. Mia is a British mother of three living in Ottawa, Canada, and before becoming a journalist, she was a teacher. So, with that, we will let you enjoy our conversation with Mia Hughes.
Hi, I'm Stella O'Malley, a psychotherapist in Ireland.
And I'm Sasha Ayad, an adolescent therapist in the United States.
And this is Gender, A Wider Lens, a podcast dedicated to the shifting concepts around gender in our contemporary culture.
Through in-depth interviews, personal stories, and psychological exploration, we seek to open up the discourse around this hot-button issue.
Join us as we look at gender from a wider lens.
Hi, Stella, and welcome, Mia. We're so glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I feel like it's my two pals here, because me and Mia have struck up a friendship, and Sasha's my old Scotia. So
I was just going to say, you guys have been working together a lot lately with the release of the WPATH files. So I know you guys have become quite friendly and acquainted with one another. And I'm hoping to learn a little bit more about you today, Mia, and then, of course, for our listeners as well. So just really glad you're here.
Thanks.
So we were thinking about starting, just in case people who are listening here aren't familiar with what is WPATH, what are these WPATH files, why does this really even matter? Maybe we'll just start with a little bit of background. So can you kind of share, what is WPATH? What is this organization?
Right. The World Professional Association for Transgender Health. This is This is a group that has a very carefully crafted public image as a leading scientific and medical organization advocating for the best evidence-based care for transgender people. They've been around since 1978. They formed and they were the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, HBIGDA.
And rolls right off your tongue, doesn't it?
Right. It's catchy, not the best acronym. So in my mind, I like to think, being generous, I like to think that in the early days, while this was a really obscure field of medicine and probably attracted some unusual types, I would like to think that in the early days, they were at least pursuing science in their own way. They were at least looking for the best way to help people suffering from what we now call gender dysphoria, which, however you want to define it, you can be quite sure that the suffering is real and the pain is real. And then I think around the late 1990s, this organization took a turn for the ideological. And I think the reason for that is because activists started to join the group, more and more trans activists, because the political trans rights movement was really getting off the ground at the same time, running parallel. And a whole bunch of activists started to join HBIGDA. And then they're less pursuing science and more pursuing activism, with a sprinkling of science in there for good measure. And as the first decade of this century progresses, we've got just more and more activists join. And then in 2007, this is the pivotal moment. They rebrand, they become WPATH, and it sounds very professional and very respectable, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. Very fittingly, I think they self-identified as a world-leading medical and scientific group. They just gave themselves mm-hmm. this name and it and people fell for it. So mm-hmm. then you've got, they're very much involved in activism. Around like 2010, they make this crazy statement, the de-psychopathologization of gender dysphoria, gender identity issues, where they decide, based on no science whatsoever, that gender identity disorder is not a mental health issue. It's a perfectly natural, healthy state of being. And the issue is the discomfort that you feel because your body and your gender identity don't align. And from that point on, it becomes affirmation. Affirm the gender identity, and to treat the discomfort, the only option is medical transition. If there's nothing you can do about the identity that's natural and healthy, all you can do is treat the discomfort with this medical pathway. So Standards of Care 7 comes out in 2012. This is very, very clear, the ideological shift at this point, that it's all affirmation, it's all medical intervention. And, you know, psychotherapy viewed very suspiciously as conversion therapy, and the role of mental health just becomes a facilitator for medical transition. You're just writing the referral letters and off you go. And then, you know, a decade passes between Standards of Care 7 and Standards of Care 8, and they really plunge into ideological terrain at this point. Many people will know about the infamous Standards of Care 8 eunuch chapter. Mm-hmm. You know, when a healthcare organization, supposedly scientific, supposedly medical, releases a guideline with an entire chapter on eunuch as a valid gender identity in need of surgical and hormonal castration, you know something has gone very wrong within. And what mm-hmm. went wrong was political activism. They became overrun with activists.
Yeah. And I'd love to add to, in addition to becoming more and more oriented towards kind of ideological and political activism, this group, as you mentioned, the self-appointed kind of authority on trans medicine, was indeed looked to by medical associations and physicians and training programs and medical schools as the people who are experts in the field, and that they know best. And it's really interesting. I think by definition, when you have a condition that used to be quite marginalized, quite atypical, quite small in numbers, I think the general public and maybe even normie physicians who aren't in this world, they think it must take specialized knowledge to understand this because it is such a kind of an anomaly. So I think it almost, whether it was deliberate or not, it kind of was, it almost felt inevitable that you could have fringe views coming to dominate this area of medicine, because I think it's so unfamiliar to most physicians, doctors, therapists, people in general. And so can you talk a little bit about the influence that WPATH has on the treatment of individuals? Like, they're not just a weird activist fringe group that's self-appointed. They're really taken seriously by kind of big institutions.
That's the remarkable thing. You see, I can understand how we were, well, how I, on the outside, as a totally non-medical person, was duped. Because it is very impressive. They've got a peer-reviewed journal. They've got this giant bibliography of scientific literature that to the average person, it looks legit. You know, you've got hundreds and hundreds of citations. But yeah, the fact that they have such influence within the medical world, we've got, you know, I live in Canada, so all across Canada, every gender clinic looks to WPATH for guidance on how to treat people suffering from gender distress. We've got, you know, all of the medical associations, I don't know if it's accurate to say, I guess they do follow WPATH's lead. So the AMA, the Endocrine Society, the AAP, but it's also more than that, because it's the WPATH members very often are also members of the Endocrine Society. So if you look at the Endocrine Society's guidelines, 2017, I think it was, half of them are WPATH members. So it's not just that these organizations are looking to WPATH for guidance, but these organizations are populated with WPATH members who then on the inside are spreading the gender affirming ideology that stems from WPATH. We've got all over the world, you see people quoting WPATH standards of care, like standards of care 8. I think whenever I see that on a medical, a clinic's website, I think, have you read it? Have you read the eunuch chapter?
Could I add a kind of a really insidious aspect of it? In Ireland, for example, in Ireland, they rejected WPATH, but for the adults, the children still uphold the WPATH guidelines, for want of a better phrase. But what people use is this phrase, international best practice, and it sounds very, very impressive. And so again and again, in all sorts of activist world, when they're trying to bring in some extraordinary things like phallus-preserving vaginoplasties and eunuch identities and some extraordinary interventions, they say, well, international best practice supports this. And it's you have to be very confident in yourself to say no to international best practice. So to me, that's a really underplayed, heavily influential aspect of WPATH.
It takes a lot to dismiss a document that has hundreds of scientific pieces of literature cited in it as well. You see, even for me, I read the eunuch chapter when it came out, and totally mind blown and everything. But only recently did I go in and start reading the actual citations. And only then did I realize what absolute garbage they all are. Just study after study after study with no control groups whatsoever, high loss to follow up, or, you know, no follow-up or 3-month, 6-month follow-up periods, just absolute garbage science. And if you don't click on those citations, you won't know that. You'll just see hundreds of citations and every statement is backed up. And it's a very convincing facade.
Mm-hmm. So in the report you wrote recently about these leaked WPATH files, you talk a lot about this. Can you give listeners an overview? What was leaked? What did you find in these leaked documents? And I'd love to talk about the WPATH response in a minute. I'm trying to kind of go step by step. There's so much here. But yeah, what did you guys... You and Michael Schellenberger in the organization Environmental Progress, what did you discover in these leaked documents from WPATH?
So this is an internal, they have an internal messaging forum. Everyone who is a member of WPATH has access to this forum. We got, I don't even know, maybe it's about 150 pages at this point of screenshots of these internal messages. And basically what you see in there, and the whole point of the report, is to, when I say, I make two points, that this is not medicine and this is not science. So inside the forum, first and foremost, when I think medicine, I think first do no harm. That should be the overarching principle of medicine. And then in the forum, you see members discussing very obvious harm, and it's iatrogenic harm. So it's harm that has occurred because of the treatment that these people are providing to a very distressed and vulnerable cohort of patients. So in basically how this forum works is somebody shows up and they post an original, it's usually a case study about a specific patient. So in the harm section, there's one, like a very distressing part is the iatrogenic harm of testosterone in females. And so somebody shows up and they've got a 16-year-old girl who was in the ER with pelvic inflammatory disease. She's been on testosterone for a few years. She's got vaginal and uterine atrophy. She's bleeding. She's all sorts of terrible, terrible symptoms that are the result of the medical treatment. Otherwise, she would be perfectly healthy. And so this person comes in and they're like, I don't know what to do. What have you seen this before? And as you see time and time again in the forum, a whole chorus of people come along and they share anecdotes. So they will, so when somebody medical will come along and say, oh, I had that and I tried this. And somebody else will say, I saw one patient with that and I tried this. And you can see that it's experimental in the fact that nobody shows up saying, oh, this study here, read this, this will tell you what to do. Or this is the guideline from Standards of Care 8. This is what you have to do, because yeah, nobody knows what to do, because mm-hmm, it's all entirely experimental. Mm-hmm. But the crucial part in like this thread, and it plays out in all of them, is a bunch of trans-identified females show up. And they say, I had that, and this is what I did. And to me, that's when the conversation, even if these were real medical professionals, which I do not believe they are, I think they're more activist clinicians than real doctors. But even if they were real doctors, and even if they did care about the health and well-being of this 16-year-old girl and all like her, they now can't say anything because they are in the presence of a person who has made that medical decision for herself and is dealing with the consequences of it. So there's no open debate and discussion about whether testosterone is safe for females, whether it is a good idea to use it as the first and only line of treatment and for, you know, dismissing psychotherapy altogether. You can't have that conversation because you're in the presence of someone who's made that medical decision for themselves. So what the files to me show is on the inside, I mean, we know that they're acting. You really don't end up with a eunuch chapter. I'm sorry to keep going on about mm-hmm, the eunuch chapter, okay, but you don't end up with a eunuch yeah, chapter if you're not a bunch of activists. But the files, and when you see what's going on the inside, you really, really do see how activist-led all of the patient care is because of the conversations that are going on the inside, that there's not open debate and discussion like there should be in any real medical organization.
Yeah, that kind of, like when somebody comes in and says maybe they're, you know, they have pain on orgasm, or that they're incontinent or that they have bleeding after sex. And it's very hard for a clinician, imagine, to come in and say, well, that clearly isn't an ideal solution. Let's try something else. You're effectively stifled. You know what I mean? So you're left to go, we could try that. It's very interesting when we've moved from kind of client-centered to client-led care. And this is a very good example of it. And I think we as an industry, and I'm talking about medical and therapeutic, we've kind of lost our way because we did start getting led by clients and patients rather than being centered. And when we centered them, you know, I do think it's important that clinicians can speak freely to each other, sometimes without patients. I think there's real value in that for really kind of pressure testing and critical analysis of any kind of treatment paths. But this idea of always centering patients within it, and now we've moved to client-led, so now they're leading the way. I just think actually theoretically and practically speaking, it's not a good move. And I'm saying that for all sorts of things. This idea that, you know, any conference with that might be is a conference about addiction should have addicts leading the way. It's not necessarily true. The lived experience has been kind of glorified.
And I mean, I think there's a place for maybe separate conversations where providers and patients can come together and patients are given kind of a forum to air their concerns or share their experience. But if the entire model of guideline development is based on centering patient preferences and patient experiences, you're dealing with something different. And in addition to that, this is something Carrie Mendoza always raises, like, what are we actually treating? Because if you have, let's say, a patient population of people who suffered from a heart attack, there was like a tangible and concrete event that they experienced. And, you know, yes, clinicians and physicians need a separate space, you know, aside from the patients to talk, but there might be value in hearing from the patients. But when we're talking about something as esoteric and subjective and individual and personalized as somebody's felt sense of gender, that certainly cannot be the driving force of the treatment model.
And it's all of the people in there who have modified their body on the basis of that internal sense of gender, whatever, they have got a very powerful interest in medical transition being the right, the only approach and the right approach, because they have to have made the right decision for themselves. So again, if these are the people who are shaping the conversations on the inside. And there's actually, when you talk about the standards of care, there's a really interesting video of Marcy Bowers in 2018. And it's quite interesting to watch. It's the Be Bold speech. So Bowers, have you seen it? Bowers is at the 2018 WPATH conference in Argentina, I think. And he's talking to, I don't know if it's just the Standards of Care 8 committee or if it's a wider audience. And he's basically telling the Standards of Care 8 committee to be bold. And there's a really interesting line in it, you know, because he's asking for them to get rid of gatekeeping, get rid of the need for surgery, the referral letters, lower the age limit for surgical intervention for adolescents. But he says a really interesting thing, and it's something like, I have been talking to members, especially transgender members of our group, and they all say that gatekeeping is unnecessary and it's discrimination. And it's like, there's the problem right there, that he's talking to the transgender members, and they are the ones that they don't like gatekeeping because they just want access to medical intervention on demand. But then that's being applied to the adolescent chapter and to the younger people who would really benefit. I mean, I think everyone would benefit from a whole lot more gatekeeping.
And a lot more attention to the concept of experimental. If you're going to treat anybody with experimental drugs, I see it, you know, I saw it with, you know, Alistair who worked with me, and he was put on an experimental treatment for cancer, but he had to sign this and sign that, and it was so scientific because they're gathering data. when they're on experimental. And this is for very serious stage four cancer. But as well as that, Helen Joyce helped myself and Mia. And, you know, we had a kind of a team that were kind of helping kind of with the PR, I suppose, for want of a better phrase, around the WPATH files. And she made a very good point about her dad. And effectively, I think it's something like he had a hip operation and then 10 years later had another operation, and they went in a completely, you know, they might have gone in the side the first time and then in the back the second time, because medical advances are happening very, very fast. And so doctors are used to the concept of experimental. We're trying this. This is getting better results. Key point, it's getting mm-hmm. better results because we are following this diligently. And that is the gaping hole right in the center of the gender industry. The loss to follow up, we do not know. We don't know. 40% loss to follow up, 25% loss to follow up. We haven't really collected the data because we're not really asking the right questions. We have some very, very happy people who are advocates for it, but this isn't as clinically, forensically, scientifically followed up population. That to me is the center of the issue. Well, of many, many of the issues.
Mm. We hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as we are. We just wanted to take a quick moment and say thank you to all of our listeners. Your support helps us to keep the lights on and the mics hot.
We recently made the switch to Substack so we could build a more robust listener community. Visit widerlenspod.com and check out the different subscription tiers.
For just $8 a month, premium subscribers get access to weekly bonus content, discussion posts, and more.
And founding members get the inside track on who's coming up on the show, with the ability to submit their own questions for our esteemed guests.
For those of you who are in need of parenting support and resources, we each have parent coaching membership groups. Plus, you can buy our book, When Kids Say They're Trans.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, don't forget to like and subscribe, and get involved in the lively discourse in the comments section.
Thank you so much. Now back to the show.
Mia, I think it's very interesting. You've told me before, but I'd love other people to hear. How did you come to be involved in gender? I knew you and Sasha knew you through your tweets. How was it that Michael Schellenberger decided that you were the person to work with him on the WPATH files? Could you tell us the lead up and then the event of that?
Right. Do you want me to go back to my first moment when I discovered gender and then take it from there?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Why not?
Okay. It's kind of a good story. So I was a bit woke prior to December 19th, 2019. I have to confess that I was a little bit woke because I immigrated to Canada. You know, I was living in Asia. I had my first child in Asia, met a Canadian, moved to Canada, leaned to the left politically. And so everyone that I met here was typically on the left. And that means woke in Canada. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was a mother. I was a stay-at-home mother. I had three children. I was busy being a mother, getting no sleep, breastfeeding children, like making sure that they don't die each day and all that stuff. You know, I was preoccupied. I didn't have time to think about politics and think deeply about anything. So I was aware of this whole trans women are women thing. I thought it was odd, but I went along with it to be kind. And then on December 19th, 2019, J.K. Rowling tweeted in support of Maya Forstetter. Maya had lost her job for saying men are not women, basically. And J.K.'s tweet, I should remember it, but I don't. But it was gorgeously worded. It seemed perfectly reasonable. I read it. I was like, yep, that seems fine. All is well. And then I saw people in absolute meltdown, being so viciously awful to her, calling her a TERF, calling her a transphobe. And so I thought, I didn't understand what the problem was. And I actually asked woke friends in my real life. And they were also calling her a TERF and a transphobe. I even remember that day somebody shared that absolutely hilariously named Scientific American article, "Stop Using Phony Science to Justify Your Transphobia." Just like all of it was baffling. But what I understood on that day was that we were supposed to believe that trans women were women, like actually believe it, real, like women just like us. And that was nonsense to me. That was utterly absurd. So I continued reading all of these threads. I saw lesbians in battle with trans activists over the concept of the male lesbian. Mm. And I just thought, this is so completely absurd. A male lesbian. I had never heard anything more stupid in my life. And shortly after that, I discovered what's happening to children. Within days, it became apparent children were being taught that they could be born in the wrong body. Mm. Adolescents were having healthy body parts amputated. And so that was the as soon as I discovered that, I couldn't look away. This was just a crime of unimaginable proportions to me. I just couldn't understand how it was happening. So I started tweeting about it. And this is not the Twitter account I have now. Like so many before me, I got suspended in the pre-Elon days. And so I started tweeting about it. And then it was not long after that that I came out in my real life. And it was, you know, all hell broke loose in my real life when, you know, this, I came out as a TERF. Mm. And so anyway, the reason, because of the scandal, because of the scandal in pediatric gender clinics, it didn't make any sense to me. So I turned to history because I turned to past medical scandals, reading about those to try and help make sense of the current medical scandal. And it really helped. It helped to see how catastrophically wrong things have gone in the past. And just, you know, you can take the framework of any past medical scandal and pretty much just plonk it on this one, add a few crazy elements, and it's the same thing. So after I got suspended, and it's kind of funny because I got suspended, I built my account up to a few thousand, and then I got suspended. And I waited about a month or something for my appeal. And in that month, I had no Twitter. I didn't have Twitter sucking all my time. So I was really reading. I was reading, read so many books and all sorts mm-hmm. of stuff. And when I came back, I just changed my approach to Twitter. And I, instead of just the sort of angry tweeting and the like just single tweets, I started to write threads about everything that I'd read now, about the social contagions, about the medical history, comparing and what's happening now. And that's how this account grew much faster than the other one did. It really, this account just exploded. And so I ended up, based on a Twitter thread, I ended up working for the Postmillennial, covering gender full time. Wow. And then last...
were you a teacher when this was happening?
Oh, right. Okay. So I was actually at this point, this is COVID. I was homeschooling my kids.
Okay. You were at home with the kids.
So I had been a stay-at-home mom for 9 years. I made it back into the workforce for about 18 months. COVID hit. I lost my job and then I homeschooled my kids. So at this point I'm homeschooling and it was all very perfect timing. Like the morning of my children's first day back at school, when I had said to my husband, okay, this is it. I'm going to put them back in school and then I'm going to look for a job. The very morning, while I was down at the bus stop putting my kids on the school bus, the editor of the Postmillennial sent me a DM on Twitter offering me a full-time job covering gender.
Wow.
So that's what I did. And then last February, I wrote a Twitter thread, it's always a Twitter thread. I wrote a Twitter thread about apotemnophilia, which is the psychiatric condition, you could call it a paraphilia, in which people want a healthy limb amputated, or sometimes like it can be both legs, it can be one leg, it can be an arm. And the thread was a thought experiment about imagine a world in which a powerful apotemnophile lobby group succeeds in convincing society that apotemnophile rights is the next civil rights movement, just like the trans rights movement mm-hmm. did. Mm-hmm. And then you see a social contagion of kids wanting their healthy limbs cut off, and we're all supposed to celebrate it. Imagine surgeons advertising their amputation services to kids on TikTok, like, you know, the one in Florida who advertises her mastectomies. And so the thread went viral, which was a surprise. It's always a surprise to me. And this guy called Michael Schellenberger showed up in my DMs offering me a job that day. And I don't think he'll mind me saying, but I didn't know who he was. So the thread was going viral. And it was really stressful for me. I find this kind of thing very stressful. It's like an overload of adrenaline and dopamine or something. So I do recall looking at his Twitter account, and I could see he had hundreds of thousands of followers, but I had somehow missed his involvement in the Twitter files. I was aware of the Twitter files, but I had somehow missed his involvement. So I turned him down that day. I very politely, you know, thank you, but I already have a job kind of thing. And thankfully he was persistent. He came back and we had this idea of combining a whole bunch of my threads into a big essay. And we did that and it was great. And so eventually I went over and I was writing. I worked for Michael full time. And almost right away, he got the WPATH files, the first batch from the whistleblower, which we tried to turn into a series of articles for public because that's where I was working at that point. But it didn't work. It was just too much information. We couldn't do the files justice. So then he moved me over to Environmental Progress, and we worked, I worked on this, the big, big think tank report.
And it really is a book, I think, in many ways. I think if any bright and savvy publisher out there, I think it's a book that's pretty much written, in my own view.
It does feel as though I wrote a book, certainly.
Yeah. We want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Genspect and Therapy First. Genspect is an international organization committed to fostering a healthy approach to sex and gender. The team and members of Genspect strive to promote high-quality, evidence-based care for gender nonconforming individuals. Genspect is pleased to offer a non-medicalized approach to gender with their recently published Gender Framework, and they continue to hold conferences around the world. Visit genspect.org to learn more.
Therapy First is a non-profit worldwide professional association of mental health providers who view psychotherapy as the appropriate first-line treatment for gender dysphoria. Therapy First supports psychotherapists working with gender dysphoric youth and young adults and offers public education on mental health and psychotherapy. Visit therapyfirst.org to learn more.
Now, back to the show. Well, you go through four specific medical scandals from the past to try and elucidate, you know, some ideas about how we got here with pediatric gender medicine. Can you maybe pick one and tell us a little bit about it, just so that listeners who are becoming familiar with the pediatric gender thing can hear, oh, like something similar has happened before. Pick one.
Sure. I mean, the four are lobotomies, ovariotomies, apotemnophilia, the one that I was just talking about, and then the experiment to correct, supposedly, the height of tall and short children with hormones. My favorite of the case studies is ovariotomy. I chose those particular four because I think elements of each can be combined into what we are now seeing. I see now this scandal as being the super scandal because it combines elements of all of those four. So, but let's talk about ovariotomy because it's my favorite. This was the worst medical scandal of the 19th century. And this was, so they were removing the healthy ovaries of women for basically all forms of madness by the end of all sorts of mental health issues. And so this was a time before antibiotics and before surgical cleanliness. So approximately 30% died. And we're talking about 100,000 women, they estimate.
God. Oh, my God.
And it was based on an entirely pseudoscientific idea called reflex theory. And the idea was that an organ in the body could create symptoms in a distant organ in the body. They were all connected somehow. And so it was basically so the ovaries were affecting the brain in women. And they first of all, the surgeons, I think, were very, you know, they were on something of a quest because they had developed these new surgical techniques and they were eager to try them out in whatever place they could. And and we're talking leading surgeons at the time. We're not talking just a few cranks over on the side. We're talking leading surgeons at the time. It is the 19th century, so they can be somewhat forgiven. But the part that I really like about it is the fact that the women at the time imbibed the narrative of reflex theory, and they began, the women who were in distress, women who were in an unhappy place and struggling, began to fixate on their ovaries as the source of their mental distress. And then they were the ones who were showing up and asking the surgeons to remove their perfectly healthy ovaries. And then even some of them would say afterwards that they were cured, that they, one that's really similar to now, in that, you know, one of the women says, I don't even think I would be here if I hadn't, you know, if I hadn't had my ovaries removed. It saved my life, which is so similar to these young women now, because again, it's based entirely on a pseudoscientific idea, and it actually was not beneficial at all. Of course, there was no link between the ovaries and a woman's mental illness. But because they were convinced it would work, the power of the mind, placebo, it worked for them, and they were satisfied.
I want to ask you something about this, because, I mean, anyone who's been following my work knows I've been saying that this is a medical scandal, and I've written about lobotomies and things like that. So I am there with you. But I kind of have this other thought in my mind about the inherently sexual nature of gender dysphoria. And particularly when you think about the male fantasy of becoming a woman, that is a documented phenomenon that has happened kind of organically outside of the contemporary culture-bound syndrome piece. And I think that that desire for some men to embody womanhood was the original driver behind the Harry Benjamin Society. Like, there is a thread of a real, let's say, condition that has woven its way through this entire history of trans medicine. And of course, with the addition of queer theory and this kind of patient-led stuff, all the things we talk about, it's blown up into something very different. But, you know, do you think that's a fair comparison? Because I suspect that with the scandals we're discussing, those things are long gone. And the desire for women to get their ovaries removed is also, as far as I can tell, long gone. But I don't think we will ever reach a point where some adult males don't want to become women. So I don't think trans medicine is going to follow the same path as the other medical scandals.
Could I add something else to that point, though? Because there is a couple of other points. When you look at the Harry Benjamin Society, HBI, GDA, the Harry Benjamin Association, you know, pre that, you know, Reed Erickson was born a female and, you know, was a millionaire back in the 60s and inherited. And born a female became a male. Rita Erickson turned into Reed Erickson in 1963. And, you know, through Harry Benjamin's quackery, for want of a better word, because it was absolute snake oil salesman, as far as I can see, Harry Benjamin. So there's something about the very fixated, very rich person who can get very far. So Reed Erickson started the EEF, which is the Erickson Educational Foundation, which is the precursor. This is like 1964, which was very well funded. And it was really extraordinary how far they went. So I think to add, while I totally agree with you, Sasha, there is one or two other elements that I also would be interested in what Mia's take is, which is the desire for some doctors to be gods, you know, to create things. And if somebody has money to fund it, how far from ethics these doctors will go. I think that's underestimated in all this.
So first to your point, Sasha, the four scandals that I chose are, each one deals with a particular element of today's scandal. So the ovariotomy one was deliberately, well, it was just comparing basically the ROGD, teenage girls and young women who have this cohort of young women and girls who have imbibed the narrative of the modern trans rights movement, coalesced all of their mental distress into a fixation on removing the healthy breasts, and very much and often can go down to the uterus and the ovaries as well. And so that's the comparison that I'm drawing, because I think one of the biggest problems we have here is all of these disparate groups who are lumped into people suffering from gender dysphoria or transgender people even. And so for me, yeah, your average autogynephilic man has got nothing at all in common with the girl who is in distress and who has fixated on her mm-hmm. ovary or on her breasts or on her ovaries or whatever. And so these are two very different groups. Autogynephilia, I mean, I didn't really address it too much in the report, but if I'm going to put it anywhere, I'm putting it with the apotemnophilia mm-hmm. case study, because it's totally separate. And I do believe, sure, we probably had some sort of autogynephilia. The presence of autogynephilia can probably be documented for a very long time. I'm no expert, but I do think that perhaps it's something that is only really present in times of abundance and sort of affluence, because yeah. I don't know that men, they're weird and stuff, but I don't know that men and their fetishes are really a thing in times of war and famine. Maybe they are, maybe they've still got their thing going then, but I think probably, yeah, autogynephilia in certain forms has been present and could be documented over a long time. But that's not who I'm talking about when I'm talking about ovariotomy. I don't know that it comes across in the report. Like, there's a little subheading under each case study to say, this is what I'm comparing. I'm taking just this one part of today's scandal. Mm-hmm. I'm comparing to this past scandal. And that's what I mean when I say, you can combine all four of the scandals that I put in the report, elements of, you can put them all together and you've got today's super scandal. So I don't know that we're ever going to be, that I think there will always be, particularly now that we've unleashed this upon society and this medical treatment exists. Yeah. And as long as this hormonal and surgical medical treatment exists, there will be autogynephilic men who will fixate on it and obsess over it and desperately desire it. And it will become so, it is an obsession, a compulsion. And so I don't know that I see a way that we get past that, but I do see a way. I hope very much that we get past this ROGD, or for want of a better term, all of these teenage girls and young women who are getting sucked into just the social contagion angle of it, and
the gay young people who just feel like their life now is better as a trans person. I mean, the ROGD and the gay, sometimes, of course, there's overlap. Of course, I work with girls who seemingly are ROGD, but actually are lesbian. But of course, yes, you were saying, like, you do see a way, hopefully, out of it for those populations that are not, let's say, the autogynephilic males.
Right, because I don't know that autogynephilia is a social contagion. I did read... it was a piece by a detransitioner who introduced me to the concept of rapid onset autogynephilia, which was, I brought it up with Michael Bailey and he was like, not buying it at all. He doesn't think so, but I don't think we're looking at, I don't know that we have a social contagion of autogynephilia. Lord help us if we do. But I think I can go off on a tangent here, and can I talk about Ian Hacking?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Ian Hacking was a Canadian philosopher. He died not very long ago, and his work was absolutely brilliant. If you want to understand what's going on now, you can't go wrong with reading Ian Hacking. And so he has this idea of so there are transient mental illnesses that arise at a certain time, in a certain place, they spread, and then they disappear. And he has this lovely metaphor of the ecological niche of a transient mental illness, where you need a certain set of cultural factors to be present at the same time for one of these mental illnesses to land in the ecological niche and then just flourish. And so if you're talking rapid onset gender dysphoria or this current epidemic of gender dysphoria, the cultural factor of the modern trans rights movement with its really powerful messaging about everyone possesses a gender identity, the fact that you're being bombarded with it in your schools and on social media, and it's coming at these young people from every single angle in society, that is one factor for its ecological niche. And then there's another, you know, it has to be observable, which it's the most observable possible mental mm-hmm. illness you could ever have. You know, they've got their flags, they've got their pronouns, they've got the physical changes to their body, and it's a very observable thing for the contagion to take hold. It has to provide release, and sure, it provides them with release from female puberty, it provides them with release from their misery, it promises them, you know, that they're going to be happy and strong and confident men. And so they, of course, they're jumping into it. And then it also, the medical world has to legitimize it. That's the fourth factor. Those are the four. But his idea is that you just, like any ecological niche for any species, if one factor disappears, the transient mental illness as well will also disappear. And so if and when we can ever get past our fascination with trans rights, if we can abolish the whole idea of gender identity, if we can get all of this, if we can get this poisonous lie out of schools, and if we can get everybody to come back to reality that, you know, there is no such thing as a gender identity. Yes, this is a complex mental health issue, and if you have it, you deserve some sort of help. But forget this messaging that seduces all of these young teenage girls and young women who are in a place of distress and are making sense of their lives through the lens of the modern trans rights movement. So I do have hope that if we can shift beyond this cultural moment, it should disappear. But I'm not talking about autogynephilia here.
Mm. How would hacking understand, let's say, the arrival of anorexia and the way it stayed, and the arrival of bulimia and it stayed, and then the arrival of self-harming as a phenomenon among, you know, that started among teenage girls and has remained as a coping mechanism?
Exactly. You see, I don't think those aren't actually very, they're not really transient. There are some that like for hacking, he's talking about, he wrote largely about multiple personality disorder. If we want to go there, we can. Hysteria in mm-hmm. Freud's time, fugue in the 19th century. So we are talking the type of mental illness that just attaches itself to a particular cultural movement or a particular cultural moment. And then when that cultural moment is over, the mental illness disappears. The trouble with bulimia and anorexia is they were never really attached to any particular moment in the culture. Another concept of his is this semantic contagion, where the naming and describing of a condition creates the means by which it spreads. It's no coincidence that the bulimia contagion that started, that was in the 1980s and 90s, started with bulimia's inclusion in the DSM-3 in 1980. The exact same thing with multiple personality disorder. Once it's named and described, and it's unleashed, and it's sometimes it's very difficult to rein in bulimia mm-hmm. and anorexia, because it's simply body image. It's just simply women looking at themselves and not measuring up and internalized.
Mm. Have you read Ethan Waters' Crazy Like Us?
Of course. Yeah.
He talks about this, and I thought it was really interesting that eating disorders per se really had a very different flavor when they existed in kind of rural China, until some, you know, middle or upper class wealthy girl in Hong Kong fainted in the street from being malnourished. And then they brought in American journalists or American psychiatrists or something like that to explain it. And they explained eating disorders from the DSM, the US DSM perspective, which actually wasn't an accurate description of the girl who fainted. But then, of course, lo and behold, this news story spread, and then all of these wealthy young women in Hong Kong were developing an Americanized version of an eating disorder. So it's really interesting the way our narratives around a condition can create more of that flavor of the condition. I mean, that's what we're seeing with gender.
Yeah, it plants the idea. I mean, that girl tragically died on a busy Hong Kong street. She actually collapsed and died. Mm. And yeah, they had, I mean, there was, they did have something that would have resembled anorexia in some form prior to that event. But exactly, we export all of our mental, what we consider to be mental disorders. We're now, because of the global society, we are exporting them all around the world. And yeah, like they triggered a contagion, right? They triggered a contagion in Hong Kong because with the best of intentions, they were trying to prevent such an event from occurring again. And what they actually ended up doing was describing the condition and planting the thoughts into the minds of all of these vulnerable women and girls.
What do you, as we wrap up the kind of main portion here, what do you think the impact of the WPATH files and the report will be moving forward? Because, you know, we've had, it's been released in the last, I would say, 2 weeks, and we've had lots of media coverage, but more so in Britain and Europe, and we've had some coverage here in the US, but what do you think the impact of this report is going to be?
It's difficult to say. I mean, we're still getting coverage. There's been, because my expectations were probably lower, I just think it's incredible how much coverage it's had. And the only impact, I would hope that it just, people see WPATH for what it really is. This is like, I cannot take any credit for, you know, there's some people saying there's a link between the WPATH files and the NHS announcing puberty blockers being banned. I mean, that's been in the works for years. They've been looking at the evidence. They've been examining everything that's been going on in this issue. And they made the announcement right after the WPATH files. So, I mean, it's very difficult to know what the impact will be because it's very different. I think these things are much slower than many people think. We've put it out there now, plain and clear, in no uncertain terms, that this is not a medical or scientific group, and this is not a group that any real medical association or health authority or anyone should be listening to. Very difficult to know what's going to happen, what people are going to do with that information. And this type of thing can take a very long time for a professional association or even a local health authority to reverse course. They may look at it, they may think, goodness me, that this is, we thought this group was a real medical group and now we're like not so sure. But there aren't these fast knee-jerk reactions. It's a very lengthy process. I just hope people are reading it. And I, particularly in Canada, I'm always talking about Canada because that's where I live, but coast to coast, we follow WPATH. Coast to coast, we think WPATH is a real organization. And so the problem is where we needed coverage the most, we got the least coverage so far. I mean, Canada, we only got a couple of articles so far. But I still think, even without the coverage, I still think people are paying attention. I still think Twitter is a very powerful platform, and I do think that people will be reading it. It's just hard to tell what impact it's going to have right away.
Yeah.
There's one campaign got inspired from the WPATH files, which I think is really powerful. The parents and GenSpect are kind of united. There's an awful lot of organizations, kind of in parent groups, and they're writing to their local clinics to inform them, that the WPATH files have revealed that this is not a medical organization or a scientific organization, and they don't actually know the harm. Well, they now know the harm that's been done. And therefore, so each parent, like from all, let's say 25 different organizations around the world, all the parent groups are all writing to their clinics to inform them, you've got the WPATH standards of care on your website. This is now a discredited organization with discredited guidelines. What do you intend to do with this? Mm-hmm. We, you know, and we look to, for example, the NHS as a leading light, along with Sweden, Finland, France, Denmark, and other countries. So we've touched on the WPATH files in lots of different ways, with the medical scandals and the different procedures that are not scientific or medically necessary. I think what's probably been most shocking, and myself and yourself, Mia, have spoke about it extensively, is the extraordinary procedures that are not known in nature, such as I mentioned earlier, the phalloplasty preserving, the phallus preserving vaginoplasty, the minimal depth vaginoplasty, the nullification. Do you want to speak a little bit about these procedures that are being recommended by WPATH, this purported international best practice organization?
Yeah, so in the files, those are the most bizarre conversations. This is like the final chapter of my report is WPATH has no respect for medical ethics. And it's basically, this is where you see it the most, that this is, it's a very dangerous combination with the non-binary surgeries of, you've got basically queer theory in the operating theater is by the way I look at it. So there in the files, you've got these surgeons who perform non-binary surgeries. And they're talking in there about, you know, one of them is saying how comfortable he is with these surgeries where the man can keep his penis and have a surgically created vagina, where a woman can keep her reproductive organs and have the appendage made out of her forearm sewn onto her groin. There's all bizarre things going on. Like he even talks about mastectomies with customized scars and stuff. And then someone in there weighs in to say, yeah, we're creating bodies that don't exist in nature. And I just think there can be no greater violation of the Hippocratic Oath than this. It's not even an experiment, because nobody is monitoring the best way to create a second set of genitals. The nullification, nobody's tracking this. What's the safest and most effective way to nullify a body? Like that means no outer sign of any sexual organs, like, you know, smooth sexless bodies like mannequins. We have gone so far beyond anything that could be called ethical medicine at this point. And it all stems from WPATH taking its turn for the ideological and practicing political activism, but in the operating theater. And so the non-binary chapter of WPATH Standards of Care 8 is a shopping list of extreme body modification. That's all it is. And typical of WPATH, everything is medically necessary if the patient so desires. You know, it's entirely, okay, the client identifies as non-binary and wishes to have a second set of genitals. It's medically necessary because they want it, and that's it. And it plays out in the real world. This is, we have got the most baffling case ongoing here in Ontario. And it is the case of a man who identifies as non-binary and goes by she, her pronouns. And he wants to keep his penis and have a surgically created vagina. And so he applied to the provincial health insurance and they said, no, we're not covering that. And he appealed, basically, the appeal, the basis of his appeal, the argument is that to force a non-binary person to go through binary surgery is a form of conversion therapy under our conversion therapy ban, which passed a few years ago. And WPATH's non-binary chapter is quoted all the way through, not only his argument, but the appeal board ruled in his favor. And they ruled favor because WPATH says that these surgeries, they, I think they call them individually customized bodies, they are these surgeries are medically necessary healthcare for people who identify as non-binary. So, but what's really interesting in the files, in these conversations where you're reading them and you think, what am I reading? These people, what are they talking about? And nobody in there, well, all that goes on in those conversations is people policing each other's language. Mm-hmm. What language should we use to talk about these types of surgeries that create bodies that don't exist in nature? Some little activist, you know, the surgeon is talking about how comfortable he is doing all these crazy surgeries, and a little activist member comes along and sort of tells him off for using mm-hmm. cis heteronormative language, and mm-hmm. that you can't call them non-standard, because what if they're going to become standard? And you don't have to be non-binary in order to have these surgeries, so you can't call them non-binary surgeries either. And nobody is talking about the ethics of it. There's not one person in there that says, is this the right thing to do? Should we be creating a second set of genitals? Is there any ethical issue with us taking these perfectly healthy bodies and creating, the long-term health implications of these surgeries are enormous, and yet nobody is talking about that. They're just policing each other's language, and they're talking about the autonomy, the right to, if you want it, you should have it. That's it. There's no greater indication that this is a group that has totally lost its ethical compass and has no concern whatsoever for this patient cohort that it claims to be serving.
We're going to shift gears and take this into our listener community. I have a lot of questions about that, because I suspect that we're in the realm of something like, you know, boundaryless cosmetic sexual surgery or something along those lines. And I'd love to also talk with you about WPATH's response to the files and to all of the media attention. So for now, I mean, obviously we'll link to Environmental Progress and all of your work there and the report. Is there anywhere else? And of course, your amazing ex, formerly Twitter, profile. Is there anywhere else that you want to send people before we shift gears?
No, I think that's all of it.
Okay. It's been great to have you here for the full episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Mia.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Mia.
Thanks for joining us this week on Gender, A Wider Lens.
If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And be sure to visit us on Substack by going to widerlenspod.com. There you can join our listener community, access bonus content and resources, plus learn about additional ways to support the show.
Our discussions are for educational purposes and are not intended as a substitute for mental health services.